From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You probably know Bob Garfield well enough, from his funny stories in All Things Considered to his clear-eyed hosting of the public radio show On the Media. But when he started writing a memoir not so long ago, he realized you probably don't know him well enough to buy a book about his life story. So he gave up the book idea halfway in. But at some point, and this was something his wife said, he realized his work on radio, the feature pieces he had produced, and his own conflicted relationship with his Jewish culture would make for a pretty decent one-man show, a show about identity. And it's built around this question, who are you? Garfield says, in that answer is the soul of the entire nation. Bob is performing his show in Utah this weekend, and today he's joining us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not very often people have a eureka moment. Bob Garfield, the host of the public radio program On the Media, had one triggered by his wife. Bob had this idea in his head, something about identity and self-exploration. For years and years, Bob produced stories for NPR's All Things Considered. He went out on the road to find these eccentric dreamers, a man who freeze-dried dead pets, a man who believed he could save the world with his worm farm, a Nevada dentist who wanted to be a country music star. And at some point, Bob started to see a common thread in these stories, not something quaint, but something grand, about people pursuing the American dream. And Bob figured this was about identity. So he created this one-man show to explain what he's learned about Americans traveling around the country. But the show is also deeply personal because he realized, as a Jew who spent a good part of his life running away from his culture, he had his own identity issues. The show is called Ruggedly Jewish. He'll be performing it Saturday night at the Eccles Center in Park City. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. We spoke with Bob yesterday from his home in Washington, D.C., and we started with his wife and that epiphany.
Look, here's what happened. I tried to write a memoir. Why did I try to write a memoir? Who am I to write a memoir? Well, an enormous number of really astonishing things have happened to me and others I have witnessed in my decades on the road. Some of about 12 of those years on the road looking for, you know, quirky Americana, American yeah. eccentricities. So I witnessed crazy stuff, and crazy stuff happened to me over and over and over. And, you know, this has been cocktail party fodder for me for decades. And I came to realize that, you know, it also would make an interesting kind of chronicle of a traveling man. And I started writing this memoir of stuff that has happened to me and that I've seen and on the road over the decades. Right. And I got about halfway into it and I realized, yeah, this is not really, there's no reason for anyone to read this because I don't have the standing to be a memoirist. I'm not famous enough. Hmm. And I don't have some great redemption story to tell. You know, I wasn't abused as a child. I wasn't addicted to heroin. I did not pull myself up from rock bottom. No, I'm just a guy who's been on the road and seen a bunch of weird stuff. So I gave up the project halfway through. And I'm not a given up halfway through sort of guy.
Yeah.
But I did. And I was sitting with my wife. And, you know, we were talking about this. And she said, well, you know, what connects the various stories you tell is identity. And I'm like, don't say any more words from your mouth. That is it. Bingo. And I realized that I did have the narrative threads to weave together to really do something that I've been doing personally in my life, which has been struggling with the degree to which I'm Jewish, mm-hmm. and with the people who I followed for 12 or 15 years on the road who were seeking to define themselves in pursuit of the American dream as they saw it, and that it even corresponds with our particular political moment, which is the stuff of identity politics gone haywire. And in that instant, it was a genuine epiphany. I understood that I did have a story to tell, that I did have standing to tell it because of my unusual assortment of career stuff, and it is a weird bouillabaisse of stuff I've done in my journalistic career, but then I started thinking, man, a lot of this stuff is on tape,
yeah,
it's on radio, so why not, instead of doing it in memoir form, do it in stage form? And this way I was able to exploit my 0 years of acting experience. And my 0 years of playwriting experience, and put it all together in a one-man show. And that's what it is. I don't know if you were ever a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
So you've made a lanyard.
Yeah. Yes, everyone makes a lanyard. Absolutely.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So it's, three or four pieces of GIMP, the vinyl floss that you weave together and turn into a lanyard or something, the key fob.
Yep.
And that's what Ruggedly Jewish is. It is a lanyard of various narratives about identity, one of which is me trying to figure out if I'm Jewish or not.
We'll dig into this more, but give me another sense of how it's connected, how identity is connected to our current, cultural landscape and Trumpism and political division. What's the connection there?
I make the case in the piece, and I make a very solid case because I get to include only the stuff that suits my argument.
Right.
I don't have to worry about the stuff that doesn't.
Yeah.
I make the case that the search for identity is a human impulse. In fact, it is a biological impulse that covers not just the animal kingdom but also, flora as well. But in any case, that there is that it is a peculiarly American thing because it is the pursuit of happiness is guaranteed in our very founding documents. And this whole sort of there's a line in the show. This is not my dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd and his dad was a shepherd, so I suppose I'll be a shepherd too, sort of society.
Yeah.
No, we're inculcated from birth with the notion that we can do anything we want. And in fact, if we don't, we're a great disappointment to one and all. And that the American thing is to improve your station, and by any number of means, one of which is getting rich, another one is getting famous, another one sort of being the white picket fence. But I think Americans harbor grander schemes, and I have documented many of those great schemes over the years. So, I think American identity is a really national a trait. And in the world of identity politics, that can get very dicey. And I make the argument that the evolution of identity politics in this country has caused a backlash, and that backlash is called Trumpism, and that the 33% of the electorate that will support Donald Trump no matter what he does, including shooting someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue, as he discusses, has gotten that way because they are wildly dissatisfied with the way our nation has gone in the last 70 years or so. They take it as an affront to their values and their histories and their racial identity and everything else.
And they want people to finally acknowledge their own identity in some way, that they're looking.
They have found their identity in their very rage, in their resentment, and a lot was taken. They think that they are victims, and they're not entirely wrong, because whether it's the Miranda decision or the Civil Rights Act or same-sex marriage or taking the prayer out of schools, while we as a country evolved as a liberal democracy more or less along international lines and certainly European lines, each one of these gradual steps towards the fulfillment of the Bill of Rights was a slap in the face of various kind of demographic cohorts. And over 70 years of liberal democracy, the resentments have built. And meanwhile, the economic fortunes have declined. And I think the result of that is a lot of people blaming a lot of other categories of people for their fate. And that's how a guy like Trump can get elected to be president.
Let me fine-tune the theme a bit more, because there's this story that you tell right up front in the show about you making this kind of hapless attempt at going hunting with your Catholic in-laws, and which is this leaves you with this question, what is the point of trying to be something you're not? And you say in the show, and I don't want to give too much away, but you say you came to believe that in that question, you know, who are you? Is the soul of an entire nation? Would you talk a little bit about that? Because I think maybe that's just more of the idea of identity. I suppose it is.
Right. And, you know, this gets to what I was talking about before, about people trying to pursue the American dream, to pursue happiness, according to Jefferson's promise. And they did it in the damnedest ways.
Yeah.
You know, I spend some time in the show with people who are spend their last nickel to get in on the ground floor of worm ranching.
Right.
I spend some time with a very prosperous Las Vegas endodontist who decides that he can't be fully actualized as a man until he becomes a country music star.
Right.
And it is, yes, hapless is a very good way to describe it. And then, of course, I meet this woman who thinks that her talking cat is going to be her path to fame and riches. You know, I will leave it to the audience to decide whether the cat talked or not.
Yeah.
You know, again, this gets to the very notion of Americans' impulse to improve their lot, and sometimes in the most tragic ways.
Hmm.
So, nobody's satisfied, or if I would say the American instinct is not to be satisfied with the hand that you're dealt. You got to draw cards and try to improve it.
Did it surprise you, Bob, how personal this became as a show? I mean, that it wasn't just an exploration of all of the interesting people you've met along the way, but it was also a lot of self-examination, too.
And it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some confessional aspects of this thing, too. But
right.
this question of who, you know, I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to help the audience plumb their own souls to figure out what their personal journey is like. And I'm also at the same time talking out loud, plumbing my own soul and trying to understand why, even though I was, you know, born Jewish and had a Jewish and lived in a Jewish neighborhood and had Jewish education, I'm 62 years old. I've spent 45 of those years running as far away from my Jewish identity as I possibly can.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first question is, why have I done that exactly? And the second question that I eventually come up with an answer to is, where has that gotten me?
Right.
And, you know, you begin to understand that these questions do not reside solely within my psyche, but they have to do with a lot of things, from the American dream and Trumpism and people marching in the streets in Charlottesville, Virginia, and, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, the Holocaust. And you wouldn't think that talking cats and the Holocaust would show up in the same show, but they do. Also some singing and dancing.
Yeah.
Also some freeze-dried pets.
That's right. That's Bob Garfield. Along with Brooke Gladstone, he's the co-host of On the Media, which airs Saturday mornings on KUER. He's going to be in Utah on Saturday to perform his one-man show called Ruggedly Jewish. That's at the Eccles Center in Park City. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Bob Garfield, co-host of the public radio program On the Media. He's going to be in Utah on Saturday night performing a one-man show, which is about his search for identity in his own story, but also in the stories of the strange and interesting people he's met around the country. It's called Ruggedly Jewish. We'll give you details about it a little bit later in the program. The questions that you work through for yourself, you seem to have, you know, am I a good enough Jew? Have I betrayed Judaism in some way? Has Judaism betrayed me? And then this question too, you know, can you be a non-believer and a Jew at the same time? It seems like these are pretty universal questions, and everyone can plug in their own kind of maybe ethnic or religious identity, but they have these – it seems like those conflicts are kind of universal, do you think?
I think they probably are, and I think they're particularly American, as I said, and I think they're particularly the American Jewish experience. You know, you've heard the term self-loathing Jew, which I've always thought was an inaccurate characterization of what's going on in people's minds and souls, but you get the idea that you resent the very things about yourself that are, you know, that are most part of your being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way I describe it in the piece is, and I don't know if your listeners are familiar with what a mezuzah is, but a mezuzah is a little capsule, and in it is a scroll, which is a little verse from Deuteronomy reminds you that you have to honor God 24/7, come what may.
Yeah.
That's what's on this scroll in this capsule. And I had this experience where I was buying a mezuzah for my mom because she was changing apartments, and I wanted to get a mezuzah to put on her doorpost per, you know, biblical covenant.
Yeah.
And I go to some store in Los Angeles, as it turns out, because I was chasing around after earthworm ranchers. And I buy this mezuzah, and it's like $40 for a little metal capsule. And I don't know, whatever, it's for my mom. And I go to pay for it, and the guy says, wait, you don't want the scroll? And I'm like, what? $40? And it isn't loaded? But see, that's me. I'm the mezuzah without the scroll. And, you know, if you come to the show, you'll find out whether I'm okay with that.
Yeah, right. There's a part of you, though, that believes, of course, as you mentioned, look, we're all just subject to the random whims of the universe. And you go through some particular – there's a woman struck by a meteor, which is kind of a great story, and I'll leave you to tell it on stage. But you talk about how there's that part of you that, look, this is just – our existence in the universe is random cosmic mischief, as you put it. But then there's the other part of you, and I wanted you to talk about this, that says that you are a believer in belief itself. And I wanted you to explain that, if you don't mind.
Well, sure. I mean, again, because this weird agglomeration of stuff that I have done over the years, I have spent a lot of time with people who believe a whole mess of different things religiously. You know, I've been with Pentecostal snake handlers who were bitten near to death for Jesus. And I've been to an exorcism, mass exorcism, in a very lovely northwestern Indiana congregation where people are puking up demons into paper towels. What sort of demons? The demons of personal bankruptcy, the demons of infidelity, the demons of acne, you know, a list of everything that can make your life uncomfortable. And I have been in your very own Salt Lake City. I've spent time with some of them.
Yeah.
Who your listeners will recognize as believing in little blue men from outer space and a prophet named Corky.
Yep.
And, you know, they'll mummify you for a price. And I have spent time with people who have various degrees of claimed psychic abilities. I have spent a lot of time in Santa Fe, where they believe in everything. And and, you know, one thing I take from that is that, well, any particular narrative may be impeached by facts and evidence and reason, that that it helps people organize their lives.
Yeah.
It helps people deal with random misfortune. It helps people make sense of the world and to imagine a life beyond this one. Belief is a very important element of human existence, and I believe in that, just not the underlying supreme being part of it.
Yeah.
And I go into some detail as to why.
Were you expected to be a believer growing up? What level, I guess, of observance was expected? What was it like at home in that way?
That's a very good question. There is a scene in the show where it's Yom Kippur. It's the most solemn day on the Jewish calendar, the Day of Atonement, not unlike, let's say, Good Friday. And this is when you're, you know, I would say it's a come to Jesus moment, but, well, it's not that.
Right.
And you're supposed to spend the day fasting and in services, you know, praying your butt off. And my whole family was dressed to get me to, you know, to go to services and suffer for the day. And I did not wish to go. And this was a big, big, big episode. And everyone was really mad. My father was just out of his mind with rage that I would be so insolent and so forth. And I was insolent. I was 15. I was the very essence of insolence.
Yeah.
But I don't think my father was a believer. I don't think my mother was a believer. But they believed in going through the motions out of respect to 5,000 years of Jewish history, not to mention those who, you know, were murdered for their Judaism. Mm-hmm. So it was very important for them to have to observe the holiday, although, you know, I don't think they were doing any praying in synagogue when they finally dragged me there. I don't think there was any praying taking place, at least in our section. But there was observance.
Would you go now, after you've reflected on all of this, the idea that you see something valuable in the belief of Corky and snake charmers, you know, would you rethink that? Would you reconnect in a way if you were to do it again?
I am fixing to answer that question. But first, can I just say, this show is really funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're having this kind of it's a very serious conversation about identity, and there is plenty of that in Ruggedly Jewish. There's also stuff that, you know, will make you gasp with horror, but there's a lot of punchlines. So I don't want to make anyone think that they're going there, that to go to this show is to sit through a meditation about belief. It's some of that, but there's a lot of laugh lines. Okay, that said, with that disclaimer, I haven't been back, but I am no more observant than I was before, but I very much got an answer to my question. And if you sit through 84 minutes of show, you find out that it's an answer that I think is a really solid one, and it's my personal answer. It answers my question about who I am and how I got there and what my relationship is to my religion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the most hopeful thing about it is that we all have the ability to look at our lives and to face questions that seem unanswerable, and to find an answer that is satisfying, that makes you be comfortable in your own skin. And, you know, in that way, I think the show is quite hopeful.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that I've had a yarmulke on since since I started performing, because I have not.
You know, one of the things you say in the show is, you mentioned this a few times, that travel teaches. When did you start thinking about traveling? When did you go off onto the road to meet people? What was that impulse like? When did you first start doing that?
I started doing it in 85, and very shortly thereafter, early 86, I started doing it for All Things Considered.
Yeah.
I did it as a feature columnist, a syndicated feature columnist. I had this idea for years of going on the road and looking for American quirks. That's what I wanted to do. And I was going to, you know, I was working at USA Today when I started thinking about this, and they kept saying, yeah, yeah, we'll give you this, we'll give you this. But they never did. And I found someone who would underwrite this, what turned out to be 15-year expedition around America in search of Americans, in search of their own identity. And for the first number of years, I just found one crazy story after another that were funny and kind of pitiful and amusing at the same time. I called it investigative tragicomedy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was also a bit of a freak show,
yeah.
I have to confess. But after a few years of doing this, and, I found this connective thread that I thought enabled me to look at what I was doing in much loftier terms, and that was documenting the American characteristic of self-improvement. And that was helpful to me because it instead of being just an exploiter of people's weirdness, which I think I was in the first few years, mm-hmm. I became a documentarian of the American impulse to pursue happiness. And I pursued the hell out of people pursuing the hell out of happiness. And, you know, it made me feel better about myself, I don't mind telling you.
Yeah.
And but it also made me feel like I had sort of added something to the national conversation.
There's a man, one of the people you profile in this 15-year odyssey was a man who had the hiccups for something like 25 years. And there's this story that you've told that you talk about how this had absolutely changed his life for the worse. I mean, in most ways. I mean, he had the hiccups for 25 years. But at the end of the interview, you talk about how you asked him if he wanted to get rid of the hiccups.
Yeah, I have to be cautious here because on the spoiler alert grounds.
Okay.
But you are right. I spent time with a charming man named John Crossland, a great grandpa with, you know, a trillion kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, and a very humble man who had the hiccups for decades. You know, when the day I visited him, he figured he'd had them 50, he had hiccup 54 million times, which is a lot of hiccups. And obviously they were very disruptive. And he spent most of those decades trying to get rid of them. And he tried everything. In that respect, he was like other American dreamers. He was preternaturally persistent. I mean, you name it. He gave it a shot, including having a rib removed. But by the time I found him, his perspective had changed. And I will just say that he discovered that they had become part of him. And that entirely changed his relationship with the hiccups and with his own life in a very, very beautiful way.
Do you miss going out on the road? I mean, you are really good at it. Do you miss that?
Well, first of all, thank you. Secondly, no. No. I never liked the hotel rooms and the air flights and the rental cars. I never got used to that deal. But, you know, I think I have found hundreds of stories, and I don't think we need hundreds more. I don't think I would be adding anything. I was a fan of a folk musician named Michael Cooney back when I was a teenager, and he played only traditional songs. And after some performance, I'd seen him several times. I said, why don't you write your own stuff? He said, why would I want to add the repertoire of available songs is so great. Why would I presume to add to it? And, you know, obviously, if everybody took that point of view, there would be no art, right? Because art is incremental and by its very nature. But I also understood what he's saying, and I don't really, you know, I think I've created a significant enough repertoire of weirdo Americana, and I don't think the next story is going to make the difference. Every now and then I'll hear someone do a piece that I go, I wish I had found that. But for the most part, no, I'm happy to find fault with the media and the government. And also, it's indoor work, you know.
Yeah.
There's no airports.
Right.
I'm okay.
No hunting, no camping. Yeah. So let me turn to one of your preoccupations, as you've put it, trying to find a way for advertising to be healthy so it can sustain media. We checked in with you, it's been a few years now, about your book, The Chaos Scenario, where you basically you were looking at mass media imploding and the digital revolution maybe undermining advertising. And what is that going to mean for journalism in particular? Now that you're looking back, has your thesis about that, your ideas about that, how has it changed, if it has?
It hasn't changed a bit.
Really? You know,
I started writing about this 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And all of my most terrifying prognostications have materialized in the worst ways. The media economy has shrunken dramatically. The number of people employed to get the news to you has shrunken dramatically. The obscene newspaper and television profits have vanished. And the startups in the digital world that was going to save everything are almost 100% unprofitable. There is no sustainable media economy. And, you know, having spent years saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, I've spent the last 4 years with building an event called the Media Future Summit that I do in connection with the Wharton School. And with the idea of trying to find, if not a sustainable, ethical business model, at least some revenue streams that help keep the lights on so that we can have the basic journalism we need to guarantee the very democracy in which we live. And it's not going well.
Right.
I mean, you know, there are no magic beans. And while every now and then someone comes up with a notion that seems promising, certainly nothing that scales to be the salvation for everybody. And the shakeout has long since begun. Yeah. Many, many newspapers have folded, and others have dramatically, dramatically retrenched. There's hardly anyone covering the state houses of America. There's hardly anyone covering the zoning hearing boards of America or the school boards of America. We are bereft of the most basic information we need to keep an eye on the government, the governments that govern, that would govern us. And it takes a toll, and in many ways. And one of them, of course, is it makes us more susceptible to propaganda and fake news. And I mean the real fake news, yeah. Not the negative stories about the presidential administration that are called fake news.
Yeah.
And the effects have been devastating to an industry, I believe, to the body politic, and I see nothing on the horizon that's going to fix what's broke. So I'm extremely, extremely pessimistic about the prospects for a robust journalism economy in America, or the world for that matter, because these problems are not, they don't end at our borders.
You know, I had kind of held out hope that the media landscape, journalism in particular, would find, advertising, let's put it that way, would not unlike a cockroach or like a coyote, you know, manage to find a way to adapt to conditions, even bad conditions. But it doesn't seem like that's happening. There would be some nook and cranny that advertising would be able to find its way into eventually. But I don't know. I'm guessing your sense is that's not happening.
Well, there's tons of advertising.
Yeah.
But it's decreasingly effective for a number of reasons. One is there is no mass anymore. Mass has disappeared. Everything is fragmented, you know, literally hundreds of millions in hundreds of millions of little pieces. That's one thing. Another thing is that you can digitally avoid almost all advertising. And the moment people were able to avoid advertising, they did so on a grand scale. And the third thing is you can do without digitally avoiding it. You can avoid it by not looking at the part of your mobile screen or your desktop screen where the advertising is taking place.
Yeah.
It's called banner blindness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the stuff, you literally never register it. And as a consequence, and also on top of everything else, because of the digitization and the automated serving of advertising, there's fraud that costs marketers billions and billions of dollars a year. So they're not getting their money's worth. And their advertising is ineffective. And on the media side of things, what they fetch for advertising is they call digital dimes versus analog dollars. But it is not dimes, it's pennies. And nobody has enough critical mass as a publisher to be able to pay journalists or other employees enough to run a prosperous enterprise. And it's true of newspapers. It's increasingly true of the TV networks and the cable television. That business model is collapsing. And, you know, the irony is we're having this golden age of entertainment media through streaming. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with a couple of exceptions, mainly Netflix and Amazon, nobody's making a buck. And so the media environment that we are experiencing, which seems so robust, is actually underwritten by speculators betting on the come, and they're going to lose, and by volunteers and monks who are working themselves for dimes versus the dollars they used to, because that's the only work they can get.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Bob Garfield, he's the co-host of the program On the Media. On Saturday night, he's performing his one-man show called Ruggedly Jewish at the Eccles Center in Park City. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Bob Garfield, the co-host of the program On the Media. Bob is coming to Utah this weekend on Saturday night. He'll be at the Eccles Center in Park City performing his one-man show called Ruggedly Jewish. All right, let me shift gears here because I wanted to ask you about the way evolved in your thinking about Donald Trump and how to cover Trump in the current media universe. One of the things I love about On the Media are these moments when you have, and you've done this a few times, recorded these encounter sessions that you have with Brooke Gladstone, your co-host there. I think it might have been the day after Donald Trump was elected. You got together with Brooke to figure out, like, how do we move forward? How are we supposed to cover things? What do we think about what is fair? What did we miss? You know, what do we make of that? And I wanted to ask you about that, that encounter session there, because I want to shift to the latest one. But mm-hmm. let's talk about that, because it seems like and talk to me about this. You basically said that your conclusion was that you can't have it both ways. You can either amp up the skepticism and outrage, you said, or you can pull back and be more dispassionate observers, but you can't really do both. And Brooke disagreed with you on that. Would you talk to me a little bit about the conclusions you came to then?
Sure, but first let me tell you about the year before that conversation.
Okay.
You're right. There was this moment of introspection, which we recorded. You know, I wasn't happy to be doing it at the moment, but I had spent the year before the election trying to persuade not only my colleagues and on the media, but the rest of the media world, that covering the Trump campaign as a political event was the wrong way to approach it. That it was an approaching Category 5 storm, that was a imminent threat to our democracy and our way of life, and that to do so, to do anything else but cover it that way was to disserve our readers and democracy. Because, you know, all, you know, to me, it was nascent fascism. It was an assault on all of our institutions, including the Bill of Rights, which is the essence of our republic, and it scared the bejesus out of me. Yeah. And I thought it was our duty as journalists to do what we would do if a hurricane were bearing down on the Gulf Coast. My colleagues didn't agree, yeah. And but that I was permitted as part of the offering of On the Media to, you know, sort of be me, and Brooke took a, I would say, a cooler approach, and yeah. that sort of this too shall pass, and mm-hmm. we can point out the day's news without being hysterical, and that we didn't have to be Paul Revere. If we would just report the news, that would be fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, with some interpretation, and to point out that which is most outrageous, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Okay, so then he actually gets elected.
Right.
And I must say that I have never personally been more despondent in my adult life, partly because of my fears for the republic, but also partly because I never felt more impotent as a father, because my kids, I had three daughters, and they, daddy, 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 what's going to happen? Is it going to be okay? And I was unable to say, yeah, it's going to be okay, because I didn't believe that was true.
Yeah.
And I was just beside myself with grief. I mean, that's the only way to describe grief. Wow. And rage.
Yeah.
And fear. And so we had this encounter session where I expressed my fears, and Brooke was somewhat dismissive of them, because the history of America is the history of eruptions that are eventually tamped down, you know, including McCarthyism and, what's that thing called? Yeah, the Civil War. You know, she was like, we'll sort it all out.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in a very we'll sort it all out frame of mind. And I said, no, we have to be ever vigilant, and we have to constantly be a voice of warning. All right. So that was the day after the election. And then you mentioned we revisited the topic just a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah. So I have a piece of tape, and I want to play this. So, yeah, just a few months ago, you come back to this. You play that original, or at least that encounter session you had after the election, where you were working this stuff. She's telling you to calm down and get a grip, and you're saying, let's keep moving forward. And then you had this session. You said, quite an epiphany, because it was kind of gradual. But it was based on your media consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this moment.
Let me tell you how my media diet works. I get up in the morning and I read the New York Times, but I also look at Google News, which feeds me the stuff that I've most heavily read before, right? It knows your preferences, and that gives you more and more of that. Well, during the campaign, I was a heavy reader of The Nation, of The Atlantic, of Huffington Post, of The Daily Beast, of all sorts of other sources that were kind of coming at the Trump campaign from my perspective, which is, what the hell is going on? For the last 8 months, I've been seeing these things come up on my Google News feed and seeing a provocative headline about some latest Trump administration outrage, and then not reading the story. And then looking at, you know, another one from The Atlantic, which is one of the finest publications this country has to offer, and I haven't read that story either. And, you know, down the list, I'm like, why?
Okay, back to me. Why?
Yeah. Well, because I knew what they were going to say. I knew they were going to talk about the same episode that I was paying attention to and evaluate them in approximately the same way I was going to evaluate them. And, you know, to one degree or another, what I was about to see was a foregone conclusion, which means that I would be stuck in the same media bubble that I accused the political right of being stuck in. You know, why is that any different than a a conservative who sees the world only through the prism of Breitbart and Fox News and InfoWars and the Daily Caller and so forth. It ceased to be useful to me.
Right.
Okay, so then I thought, well, if I'm behaving this way about my go-to sources, how are people listening to On the Media?
Right.
Have they dismissed whatever we're going to say this week as just the foregone conclusion based on the week's events? And if that's the case, are we just in the business of validating people's worldview and not helping them frame the events in a new way? What we want to do is add perspective. It's not our job to make people feel good about themselves and to find validation in their fears. That may be the effect, but that's not what we're supposed to be out there for.
Right.
And it dawned on me that by being so vigilant, by being so angry, by being so reactive to the tragedy unfolding before us, I feared that we were losing our very raison d'etre. And that scared me, because I don't want to be I don't want to be a palliative drug for the depressed. I want to add insight. And so, you know, it makes you wonder what you do for a living. And if it's that, you know, I don't want to be the oxycodone of the airwaves.
But how do you dial it back, as you suggested you probably should? How do you dial it back and still express the concern, which I'm guessing you still have, the idea that it's the slow boiling frog idea, that there are still lies being told that have to be expressed? I mean, how do you do both of those things, dial it back and still express the urgency about the things that you're really worried about?
Well, let's just say that my evolved thinking that we just played a bit of kind of devolved very quickly, because every week or every day, in fact, about every 3 hours, I'm freshly outraged and freshly frightened and agitate heavily to, you know, give it the full OTM treatment, and the rest of the staff essentially reins me in, sometimes by ignoring me and sometimes by giving me a little bit of rope and sometimes letting me express myself in full rage. And so the answer is I haven't been able to come to terms with it myself, but there are people who have come to terms with it for me, and it's the rest of the On the Media staff. So I change my mind every 5 minutes, but I'm inclined to believe now that if I had to testify today in court, I would put my hand in the Bible that I don't believe in and say, I think we should be Paul Revere. And if that means being oxycodone for some of our audience, I'm willing to take that risk. Because for others of our audience, there's stories that have to be told, and there's perspective that has to be plumbed. And let's err on the side of hysteria.
All right, let me come back to the show finally and ask you this. You like being on the stage? You said you didn't have any experience as being an actor, but tell me about that experience. What do you love about that?
Well, I'm going to tell you that I will love it. I will come to the point where I will love it. I like to perform, although I'm not an actor. And, I have been on stage 1,000 times doing speeches and other, panels and whatever, emceeing over the years. So I'm not unfamiliar to being in front of a live audience, and I do like that. However, I'm certainly not used to this form yet. And while I don't believe the audience understands it when I do this show, I am paralyzed the entire time. You can't see it, but I don't think my image appears on film, because the anxiety, the anxiety that I'm feeling when I'm up there obliterates, it's crazy how nervous I am. And I, as I get more comfortable with this, being on the boards, I think I will eventually grow to love the experience of really having a conversation with the audience. But and I get closer to that with every iteration of Ruggedly Jewish. But, you know, it is the most nerve-wracking thing. Because not only is the content, am I bearing my soul, I am getting just emotionally naked for the audience. I don't want to lose my place. I don't want to forget my lines. I don't want to, during my dancing number, I don't want to fall down. I do not want to throw up on the stage in front of, you know, 500 people. Yeah. That's egg on your face. So all of those things are completely dominating my mind as I have what looks to be a conversation with the audience. And I really look forward to the day when I'm less self-conscious and just sort of let it all flow. Ain't there yet.
It's Bob Garfield, the co-host of the public radio program On the Media. Saturday night, he's performing his one-man show. It's called Ruggedly Jewish at the Eccles Center in Park City. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Bob joined us yesterday from his home in Washington, D.C. I should also mention that we have a podcast at KUER called More to Say, where we basically unpack stories by our news reporters. There's a new episode today, which you can find online at KUER.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Claire Jones. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.